Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Okay, well, for this week's episode, we're going to do a greatest hit show, which means I curate some of the timely and timeless shows from the past that are worth repeating. So here we go. Several episodes, I examined obesity as a public health case study, and I'd like to look at several articles today that will add some additional fresh perspective on that. The first from ConscienHealth.org, Fresh Thinking Needed for Childhood Obesity. Two major research programs spanning two decades for reducing childhood obesity have yielded null results. Altogether, none of five separate studies from these two programs have shown an effect. No effect on obesity, no effect on related health outcomes either. These studies are important because they target populations where obesity is most severe, low-income urban youth. We need a new approach, says Bill Deitz in a commentary published with the studies in Pediatrics. He's absolutely right. And furthermore, we need fresh thinking about the problem itself. Both Deitz and the research clearly understand that thinking focused only on individual behaviors and choices is inadequate. Deitz writes, it should be no surprise that the behavioral interventions to prevent obesity had limited traction in families with food insecurity, lack of physical or financial access to healthful foods, unstable or low-quality housing, and exposure to violence. Likewise, the authors of the latest study are clear of the need for a new approach. Education alone is not enough to change behaviors. In addition, they write about the need for research into poverty and other determinants of health-promoting behaviors. Overall, their focus is on behaviors and the community factors that shape those behaviors. They are absolutely right to focus beyond the individual. Especially in teens, purely behavioral interventions for serious obesity have limited efficacy. Thus, expecting behavior to reverse obesity might be an unreasonable expectation. Behavior change is a good idea, certainly. Also important is addressing community factors that drive behavior, but changing behaviors that lead to other chronic diseases, like cancer or diabetes, seldom reverses those diseases. Obesity appears to be no different. When the physiology that regulates fat tissue is broken, it needs to be fixed. Therefore, we need better interventions for youth with obesity, but because the research to date has focused exclusively on behavior, we don't have them. Better interventions will only come from fresh thinking and research that goes beyond an exclusive focus on behavior. And then next up from the Canadian Medical Association Journal, fat shaming is making people sicker and heavier. Fat shaming is harmful to health and may drive weight gain. Anti-fat bias is rampant in all parts of society, including medicine. More than 3 in 5 adults with obesity encounter weight bias from health professionals. Some medical ethicists even argue that this social pressure is justified to promote weight loss. But the harms of fat shaming are well documented. Studies show that exposure to weight bias triggers psychological and physiological changes linked to poor metabolic health and increased weight gain. You actually experience a form of stress. Cortisol spikes, self-control drops, and the risk of binge eating increases. The more people are exposed to weight bias and discrimination, the more likely they are to gain weight and become obese, even if they were thin to begin with. They're also more likely to die from any cause, regardless of their body mass index. Fat shaming is also linked to depression, anxiety, low self-esteem, eating disorders, and exercise avoidance. There's emerging evidence that the severity of harm increases when people internalize weight bias and turn it on themselves. In one study, participants with high levels of internalization of weight bias had 3 times greater odds of having metabolic syndrome than those with low levels, even after controlling for body mass index and other risk factors. It's estimated that 2 in 5 Americans with a higher than normal body mass index have internalized weight bias. Weight bias and discrimination undermine health and may make it harder to lose weight. Okay, this from back to conscienhealth.org, a lifetime of medical neglect. Obesity presents many problems, but 2 of them rise to the top: access to care and bias. Too often, people with obesity endure a lifetime of derision and medical neglect. The evidence is unmistakable. People living with obesity receive poor medical care simply because of their size and the false assumptions healthcare professionals make about them. Physicians have less patience with larger patients, less respect, and less time for them. 1/3 of nurses say they don't want to care for patients with obesity. 1/4 of them say patients with obesity, quote, repulse them. Fully 90% of hospitals don't even have the imaging equipment necessary for patients with obesity. So these patients learn to avoid medical care. They are less likely to get routine preventive care. When they present with symptoms, providers attribute even unrelated problems to a person's size. Health outcomes suffer. Objective facts become human tragedies. A child with severe obesity from an early age gets little help from primary care pediatricians. Advice to eat healthier food and be more active doesn't help. It does nothing to change the underlying physiology of a child with severe obesity. A pediatrician becomes frustrated as the problem grows worse. Parent and child avoid the doctor because it's an unpleasant experience. So the child becomes an adult with severe obesity. As an adult, she receives even less care and compassion from most health providers. An orthopedic surgeon misdiagnoses her with, quote, obesity pain, but this fails to see her scoliosis. That was the real source of the pain. A surgeon refuses to repair a hernia because of a patient's weight. She receives no referral for obesity care that might actually help her overcome the underlying disease of obesity. Nope. Instruct the patient to lose weight is a standard practice, and it's utterly ineffective. As time passes, medical complications become more severe and require hospital stays. Because hospitals are not prepared to give good care to patients with severe obesity, the experience is nothing short of inhumane. These problems don't materialize overnight. They accumulate over a lifetime. Medical neglect of patients with obesity starts early, and the complications add up. Everyone contributes to the rationalization. We don't tell people with diabetes or cancer to eat less and move more. We give them good medical care. But somehow we can live with blaming people for the physiological problem of obesity, and thus the problem snowballs until it's overwhelming. We must stop. Stop blaming, shaming, and rationalizing. Obesity is no different from any other disease. Nobody wants it or chooses it, but we can do things to make it better. Better care and more compassion is a good place to start. Continuing with conscienhealth.org, glaring disparities in obesity affects care and policy. Disparities are everywhere you look in healthcare, but they're especially glaring if you take a moment to look at effects healthcare and policies related to obesity. Excess weight in racial and ethnic minorities is not just a cultural phenomenon. Research points to genetic and hormonal differences as significant contributors. We must invest in understanding these factors so that we can address them. Because obesity is already stigmatized, it's easy to dismiss racial and ethnic disparities in this disease as a function of culture and behavior. The public and most healthcare professionals already think of obesity as a simple behavioral problem, but of course, that's wrong. Regardless of the facts, both providers and researchers look past important racial and ethnic differences in obesity. Most clinical obesity research enrolls mostly white, non-Hispanic females. Where we have data, the clinical response to obesity treatment is often different for racial and ethnic minorities. For example, the response to bariatric surgery is less favorable among African Americans. It's almost impossible to miss. The impact of obesity on racial and ethnic minorities is greater. Prevalence is higher, complications are more common, and yet obesity care seems tailored to meet the needs of white, non-Hispanic women, suggesting that this fact only reflects treatment-seeking patterns is simply wrong. It should be obvious that people are less likely to seek care that's not adapted to their needs. However, the good news is that genuinely patient-centered care can be very beneficial. Build it, make it accessible, and they will come. That's a lot smarter than cleaning up the mess that results from the complications of untreated obesity. And this from July 2019. Let's start with an article from NutritionFacts.org. Why there is so much commercial corruption in nutrition. The prevalence of chronic diseases such as diabetes has skyrocketed, as has the number of articles published about diabetes in medical journals. Why does our wealth of academic knowledge not translate more directly to improving the human condition? Perhaps our overattachment to the reductionistic mindset that proved so successful with acute deficiency diseases may actually represent an obstacle to success battling chronic disease. These days, health seems to have been reduced to a highly commercialized commodity in which we marketed all sorts of high-cost, high-tech tests and treatments of dubious value with substantial risks attached. This is worrisome because most of the things that make us healthy and keep us healthy are cheap and largely available without professional help or commercial prodding. This isn't to say modern medicine can't work miracles, but what about the big picture? That is, what about the 80% of death and disability caused by preventable diet-related diseases? What about the field of nutrition? It's become about profits and products and extracting nutrients from whole foods so they can be repackaged and marketed. But food is best eaten whole. Eat the broccoli and the blueberries, not some broccoberry supplement. But the reason there aren't more studies on whole foods is fairly obvious. You can't patent them. Why should a company spend a lot of money, time, and effort to convince you to buy broccoli when any other company can sell it to you? That's why the field of nutrition can be more about marketing profitable products than educating people about the fundamentals of health and wellness. For example, the benefits of whole grains over refined grains is commonly attributed to fiber, which enables the food industry to whip out fiber-fortified Fruit Loops and make you feel all better. Let's consider this ingenious study. Burkitt and colleagues thought the extraordinarily low rates of killer chronic diseases in sub-Saharan Africa were due to all the whole, plant-based foods they were eating. This turned into the fiber hypothesis, the reductionistic thought that fiber must be the magic bullet active ingredient. What happens if we put it to the test? What if we compared two groups of older women getting about 6 grams of grain fiber a day, but one group mostly from whole grains and the other mostly from refined grains? Who do you think lived longer? If it was just the fiber, there shouldn't be much difference because both groups ate the same amount. In fact, the whole grain group lived longer and with a significantly lower mortality rate, which implies that it may be all the other wonderful things in whole plant foods linked to fiber that may confer important health benefits above and beyond the effects of fiber itself. That's why fiber supplements wouldn't be expected to offer the same benefit. Indeed, food, not nutrients, is the fundamental unit of nutrition. As Dr. David Katz has pointed out, our culture doesn't want to hear that the active ingredient in broccoli is broccoli. It wants to know what supplement it can take. This also from NutritionFacts.org. Where do you get your fiber? Vegetarians and vegans are all too familiar with the question, where do you get your protein? Well, we can finally put to rest the question of whether vegetarians get enough protein thanks to a large study that compared the nutrient profiles of about 30,000 non-vegetarians to 20,000 vegetarians and about 5,000 vegans. 5,000 flexitarians, people that are vegetarian most of the time, and 5,000 pescatarians, those that eat no meat except fish. The average requirement is 42 grams of protein a day. Meat eaters get way more than they need, and so does everyone else. Vegetarians and vegans average 70% more protein than the recommendation every day. It's surprising that there's so much fuss about protein in this country when less than 3% of adults don't make the cut, presumably because they're on extreme calorie-restricted diets and aren't eating enough food, period. But 97% of Americans get plenty of protein. There is a nutrient, though, for which 97% of Americans are deficient. That nutrient is fiber. Less than 3% of Americans get even the recommended minimum adequate intake of fiber. That's something we really have to work on. On average, we get only about 15 grams a day. The minimum daily requirement is 31.5, so we get less than half the minimum. Men are particularly deficient. If we break down intake by age and gender, after studying the diets of 12,761 Americans, the percent of men between ages 14 and 50 getting the minimum adequate intake is zero. The only nutrient Americans may be more deficient in than fiber is potassium. That is, 98% of American diets are potassium deficient. Not surprisingly, plant foods are the premier source for potassium. This deficit is stunning in that dietary fiber has been protectively associated in population studies with the risk of diabetes, metabolic syndrome, cardiovascular disease, obesity, and various cancers, as well as high cholesterol, blood pressure, and blood sugars. Therefore, it is not surprising that fiber is listed as a nutrient of concern, reported by the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee. Protein is not. One problem is that most people have no idea what's in their food. More than half of Americans think steak is a significant fiber source. By definition, fiber is only found in plants. There's no fiber in meat, dairy, or eggs, and little or no fiber in junk foods, those processed foods. Therein lies the problem. Americans should be eating more beans, vegetables, fruits, and whole grains. But how are they doing? 96% of Americans don't eat the minimum recommended daily amount of beans. 96% don't eat the measly minimum for greens. And 99% don't get enough whole grains. Nearly the entire U.S. population fails to eat enough whole plant food. Those eating completely plant-based diets triple the average American intake of fiber. Plant-derived diets tend to contribute significantly less fat, saturated fat, cholesterol, and foodborne pathogens, while at the same time offering more fiber, folate, vitamin C, and phytochemicals, all essential factors for disease prevention, optimal health, and well-being. And the more whole plant foods, the better. Actually, a completely whole food plant-based diet gives 75 to 100 or more grams of fiber a day, in stark comparison to the overprocessed omnivore standard diet in America. So get your fiber and all the great stuff that comes with it through a plant-based diet. Okay, well, now we're going to move to some stories about the dubious benefits of many drugs, particularly those regarding psychiatric issues, and with psychiatry, even the dubiousness of diagnoses. So here we go. This from Science Daily. International drug development processes and policies are irresponsible and must be reformed. More than half of new drugs entering the German healthcare system have not been shown to add benefit. Bait, Weiseler, and colleagues at the German Health Technology Assessment Agency say that international drug development processes and policies are irresponsible and must be reformed. Between 2011 and 2017, they assessed 216 drugs entering the German market following regulatory approval. Almost all of these drugs were approved by the European Medicines Agency for use throughout Europe, yet only 25% were judged to have a considerable or major added benefit. In 16%, the added benefit was either minor or could not be quantified. And for 58%, the available evidence did not prove an added benefit over standard care in the approved patient population. The situation is particularly shocking in some specialties. For example, in psychiatry, neurology, and diabetes, added benefit was shown in just 6% and 17% of assessments respectively. Some people have argued that limited information at the time of regulatory approval, and thus widespread use by patients, is the price to be paid for early access to innovative drugs, explains the authors. The reality, however, looks quite different. For instance, an evaluation of cancer drugs approved between 2009 and 2013 showed that most had been approved with no evidence of clinically significant or meaningful benefit on patient-relevant outcomes, such as survival and quality of life. And several years later, little had changed. What's more, post-marketing studies often do not happen, and globally, regulators do little to sanction non-compliant companies. Evidence also suggests that many of the investigated drugs added benefit only in subgroups of patients. For the overall patient population, the current output of drug development may thus be resulting in even less progress than our assessments suggest. Clinicians and patients deserve impartial and complete information on what to expect from a certain treatment, including information on the benefit of alternative treatments or no treatment. But given the current information gaps, this is not possible. As a consequence, patients' ability to make informed treatment decisions consonant with their preferences might be compromised, and any healthcare system hoping to call itself patient-centered is falling short of its ethical obligations. They believe that regulators should become far less tolerant of shortened drug development programs and instead should demand robust evidence from longer-term and sufficiently large randomized controlled trials to prove efficacy and safety, which in parallel could be used to collect data for health technology assessment. Information gaps could be closed further by a mandatory requirement to conduct active controlled trials. Rather than waiting for drug companies to decide what to develop, they could define the health system's needs and implement measures to ensure the development of the treatments required. I guess the moral of this story is that this is a worldwide corporate pharmaceutical industry driven problem, another outcome of profit-driven medicine that actually transcends national state boundaries. Okay, next up from Marie Claire, the burgeoning benzo crisis. When Rachel Ziegler was 22, her doctor prescribed 0.5 milligrams of Xanax once a day to treat generalized anxiety and panic attacks. "I don't recall ever discussing a potential stopping point," says Ziegler, who works as a chemistry lab technician at the University of Illinois. "But I do remember asking her if I would become addicted." Ziegler says her doctor minimized the risk, telling her, "Oh, you'll be okay. You'd have to take it like 3 times a day for 3 months to get addicted." But after about 3 months, the psychiatrist wrote her a new prescription, then another, until before she knew it, she'd been using Xanax for 6 years. Xanax is the most well-known brand in a class of drugs known as benzodiazepines. Other popular brands include Klonopin and Ativan. Benzos, as the drugs are culturally known, are sedatives for the age of anxiety, popular pre-flight fear quellers, and an instant blunter of life's sharp edges, breakups, deadlines, funerals. They're readily prescribed and passed around friend groups like brunch recommendations, and they've gotten shout-outs in everything from rap songs to the New York Times columns. Benzo-praising memes say it loud and proud. Our brains need help, and these drugs are the solve. But we don't talk enough about the consequences of use over time and withdrawal, or how women are disproportionately impacted. Women are twice as likely as men to have anxiety disorder, and thus also twice as likely to be prescribed benzodiazepines. Between 1996 and 2013, benzodiazepine prescriptions increased by 67%. From 8.1 million to 13.5 million. The increase in use and misuse has led to a concerning spike in deaths. The overdose mortality rate involving benzodiazepines for women between the ages of 30 and 64 increased by 830% between 1999 and 2017, according to a January 2019 report by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Often women don't know what they're getting into. Most people taking psychiatric drugs these days do not get an adequate explanation about the nature of the medication, says George Dawson, MD, a Minnesota-based addiction psychiatrist. That was the case for Summer Schley, a 26-year-old waitress in Valley View, Pennsylvania, who was prescribed Klonopin to help her sleep when she was 18. I didn't know what the term tolerance meant, she says. I never did pills or even drank alcohol, so I was completely unaware of what I was given. Drug packaging states physiological dependence can occur even when they're taken as prescribed, but it doesn't explain dependence is widespread among users who take the drugs for longer than 2 to 4 weeks, and many do. Between 2005 and 2015, the number of people using benzos for 6 or more months increased by 50%. Anyone who uses these medications long-term is going to experience tolerance and withdrawal, says Wilson Compton, MD, the deputy director for the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Common withdrawal symptoms include increased anxiety and heart rate, gastrointestinal symptoms, mood instability, dizziness, and cognitive difficulties. Joseph Garbley, medical director at Karen Treatment Centers, a Pennsylvania-based nonprofit dedicated to addiction and behavioral health care treatment, education, and prevention, says benzo withdrawal is the worst we deal with. Jen Chobinard, who was prescribed Klonopin for PTSD, experienced stabbing pain in her eyes, elbows, and feet, ringing in her ears, insomnia, stiff joints, and trouble concentrating when she went off the drugs. She also experienced rapid weight loss, dropping about 30 pounds. People were like, "You look fabulous," says Chenard, 33, a graduate student at the University of Saskatchewan in Canada. And I'm like, "Oh, I'm recovering from a drug addiction I didn't know I had." The best way out of this burgeoning crisis is a simple one. We should really look at limiting the number of patients on chronic benzodiazepines, says Stephen DeLisi, MD of the Hazelton Betty Ford Foundation, a national nonprofit addiction treatment provider. Part of the problem in our healthcare system is that doctors spend 10 or 11 minutes with each patient. That is not a good way to treat anxiety. There's a tendency to want to use medication for everything. Other methods, like therapy, take longer to work, but may be better in the long run. Often the solutions are outside of the pill bottle, developing healthy coping strategies and dealing with life on life's terms. Like many users, Ziegler developed a tolerance, taking up to 4 milligrams to get the same effect she did at 0.5 milligrams. I had to keep taking more to get the anxiety relief that I needed so badly, she says. Eventually, no amount seemed to be enough. In 2017, she spent a weekend withdrawing in agony in my parents' bed when she was supposed to be at a wedding. That's when I finally came to terms with the fact that a drug had me completely under its thumb, she says. I was enslaved, and it was 100% terrifying. It took Ziegler about 4 months to taper off the drugs, a period marked by panic attacks, her body temperature oscillating between sweating and shivering, and what is known as benzo rage, which she describes as the adult version of a toddler tantrum. The last pill she took was in August 2017. Benzodiazepines are extremely appealing because they work too well too fast, and Americans are all about the quick fix, says Ziegler, now 29. But it's pretty clear now we are paying the price. Okay, and perhaps a related story, this from Science Daily. Psychiatric diagnosis scientifically meaningless. A new study published in Psychiatry Research has concluded that psychiatric diagnoses are scientifically worthless as tools to identify discrete mental health disorders. The study, led by researchers from the University of Liverpool, involved a detailed analysis of 5 key chapters in the latest edition of the widely used Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, DSM, on schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, depressive disorders, anxiety disorders, and trauma-related disorders. Diagnostic manuals such as the DSM were created to provide a common diagnostic language for mental health professionals and attempt to provide a definitive list of mental health problems, including their symptoms. The main findings of the research were psychiatric diagnoses all use different decision-making rules. There is a huge amount of overlap in symptoms between diagnoses. Almost all diagnoses mask the role of trauma and adverse events. Diagnoses tell us little about the individual patient and what treatment they need. The authors conclude that diagnostic labeling represents a disingenuous categorical system. Lead researcher Dr. Kate Alsup, University of Liverpool, said, "Although diagnostic labels create the illusion of an explanation, they are scientifically meaningless and can create stigma and prejudice, I hope these findings will encourage mental health professionals to think beyond diagnoses and consider other explanations of mental distress, such as trauma and other adverse life experiences. Professor Peter Kinderman, University of Liverpool, said, "This study provides yet more evidence that the biomedical diagnostic approach to psychiatry is not fit for purpose. Diagnoses frequently and uncritically reported as real illnesses are in fact made on the basis of internally inconsistent, confused, and contradictory patterns of largely arbitrary criteria. The diagnostic system wrongly assumes that all distress results from disorder and relies heavily on subjective judgments about what is normal." Professor John Reed, University of East London, said, "Perhaps it is time we stopped pretending that medical-sounding labels contribute anything to our understanding of the complex causes of human distress or of what kind of help we need when distressed." Woohoo! Well, how's that for a fresh perspective? I'm not an expert in that field, but wow, that's something to think about.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, now we're going to switch back to a topic I know a whole lot more about than psychiatry, which is nutrition. If you're into diet and nutrition at all, certainly you've run into the paleo diet or the ketogenic diet. And I'd like to start off with that. This from JAMA Network. "The ketogenic diet for obesity and diabetes, enthusiasm outpace evidence." The ketogenic diet has recently received much attention for its promise for treating obesity and type 2 diabetes. However, the enthusiasm for its potential benefits exceeds the current evidence supporting its use for these conditions. Although the temptation is great to recommend a potentially novel approach for otherwise difficult to treat diseases, it is important to remain grounded in our appraisal of the risks, benefits, and applicability of a diet to avoid unnecessary harm and cost to patients. The ketogenic diet, or keto diet, emerged in popularity after a recent series of other low-carbohydrate diets, such as the paleo and Atkins diets. The ketogenic diet is unique from other low-carbohydrate diets in that followers of the diet are encouraged to forego nearly all carbohydrates, avoid excess protein, and consume high levels of fat, generally exceeding 70% of calories consumed, resulting in the production of ketones, giving the diet its name. The excitement for low-carbohydrate diets comes on the heels of what some have considered the failure of a low-fat diet to curb the obesity epidemic and its associated increase in type 2 diabetes. This enthusiasm is belied by the fact that the modern diet is not truly low in fat, defined as less than 30% of total calories. Of more importance, from the early 1970s to the early 2000s, Americans increased total energy consumption by at least 240 calories per day, likely contributing to weight gain and the increased incidence of diabetes. Is the ketogenic diet more effective for weight loss than other diets? In a meta-analysis of 13 studies lasting longer than a year, researchers found that the ketogenic diet was associated with less than a kilogram of additional weight loss over high-carbohydrate, low-fat strategies. This difference, although statistically significant, may not be clinically significant. Furthermore, a meta-analysis of 32 controlled feeding studies found that energy expenditure and fat loss were greater with low-fat diets compared with ketogenic diets. Any diet that results in weight loss does so because it reduces calorie intake. The ketogenic diet, when used for weight loss, is no different. The salient questions are whether it is sustainable and whether it promotes long-term health. No studies, to our knowledge, have evaluated ketogenic diet for cardiovascular events or mortality, although observational studies in the broader low-carbohydrate diet literature suggest increased all-cause mortality. What about the role of a ketogenic diet in the treatment of type 2 diabetes? One publicized non-randomized study of the ketogenic diet in persons with type 2 diabetes showed a 1.3% reduction in glycosylated hemoglobin at 1 year in the ketogenic group. Okay, I have to stop there and do some editorializing. First of all, 1.3% doesn't seem like much, but what they're measuring, this glycosylated hemoglobin, is actually a long-term measure of your average blood glucose, and like a normal level is like 5 or 6. And when they talk about a 1.3% reduction, what they mean is a 1.3% reduction from like 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, which would be what a diabetic's glycosylated hemoglobin. So actually, that was probably, for the lay public, it'd be better to talk about like a 10 or 20% decrease in the glycosylated hemoglobin. Continuing, these findings must be interpreted with caution, however, because the ketosis group was self-selected and received intensive technological and behavioral support not offered in the control group. And again, I remind you, this was a non-randomized study. Long-term, that is greater than 1 year, randomized studies tell a different story. A meta-analysis of randomized long-term studies comparing the ketogenic diet with low-fat diets for weight loss reported no significant differences in glycemic control, that's blood sugar control, among persons with type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes is characterized by carbohydrate intolerance due to insulin resistance. Restriction of carbohydrates, as in the ketogenic diet, can temporarily improve glycemic control and weight loss, and weight loss by any means can improve insulin resistance. However, there is little, if any, evidence that ketogenic diets specifically improve carbohydrate intolerance independent of weight loss. Unlike other dietary approaches in which glycemic control is improved despite the consumption of healthful carbohydrate-rich foods such as legumes, whole grains, and fruits, even in the absence of weight loss. In terms of the risk-benefit balance of the ketogenic diet, the potential adverse effects may give one pause. A review of the literature on ketogenic diets for the treatment of pediatric epilepsy reveals multiple adverse effects, ranging from the relatively benign but inconvenient keto flu, an induction period of fatigue, weakness, and gastrointestinal disturbances, to the less common but deadly occurrences of cardiac arrhythmias from selenium deficiency. Other documented adverse effects include kidney stones, constipation, bad breath, muscle cramps, headaches, diarrhea, restricted growth, bone fractures, pancreatitis, and multiple vitamin mineral deficiencies. The greatest risk, however, of the ketogenic diet may be the one most overlooked. Okay, people, I'm going to repeat that again. The greatest risk, however, of the ketogenic diet may be the one most overlooked. Here we go. The opportunity cost of not eating high-fiber, unrefined carbohydrates. Whole grains, fruits, and legumes are some of the most health-promoting foods on the planet. They are not responsible for the epidemics of type 2 diabetes or obesity, and their avoidance may do harm. In a systematic review and meta-analysis of 45 prospective studies, researchers found that whole grain intake was associated with a dose-dependent reduction in risk of coronary heart disease, cardiovascular disease, total cancer, and all-cause mortality. Similar findings have been seen with fruits and legumes. Nearly all experts agree that highly processed, refined carbohydrate-rich foods should be avoided. Blurring the distinction between refined and unrefined carbohydrates, and thus excluding both, precludes the numerous health benefits of unrefined carbohydrates. Some of the longest living populations in the so-called blue zone communities subsist on a carbohydrate fare that exceeds 50% of daily calories. Although the ketogenic diet has garnered much attention for the dietary treatment of chronic diseases such as obesity and type 2 diabetes, the evidence supporting its use is currently limited and the diet's potential risks are real. Physicians and patients should continue to judiciously appraise the benefits and risks of the ketogenic diet in accordance with the evidence, not the hype. Well, as many of you know, I am convinced that a whole food, plant-based diet is the healthiest diet for the general population. And I think this is where the keto diet and often the related paleo diet goes wrong. These can be very good, actually, behaviorally in getting people to eliminate so-called bad carbohydrates, that is, unrefined carbohydrates. Virtually nobody really thinks that's a bad thing to reduce, quote, bad carbohydrates, the refined carbohydrates. And in fact, that is a lot of the American diet. So this is a very important point. But as this article wisely pointed out, we shouldn't throw the good carbohydrates out with the bad. So enjoy those healthy carbohydrates, beans, whole grains, fruits, and vegetables. Okay, well, here at Just for the Health of It, I promote a sustainable diet that is one that's healthy for individuals, communities, and the planet. And this seems to me to be the decisive thing about going to a whole foods, plant-based diet. It's a sustainability issue. One of my previous episodes, I laid out a long litany of reasons why, if you want to be a serious environmentalist, we need to move away from animal-based foods. Okay, well, if all this talk about diet and climate change brings you anxiety, let alone talking about mental health and mental illness, this story may be for you. Okay, in a somewhat related story from People.com, feeling anxious about climate change? Therapists say you're not alone. Therapist Andrew Bryant says the landmark United Nations climate report last October brought a new mental health concern to his patients. I remember being in sessions with folks the next day. They had never mentioned climate change before, and they were like, "I keep hearing about this report," Bryant said. Some of them expressed anxious feelings, and we kept talking about it over our next sessions. Often these patients want to do something to reduce global warming, but are overwhelmed and depressed by the scope of the problem and difficulty in finding solutions. And they're anxious about how the earth will change over the rest of their and their children's lifetimes. Although it is not an official clinical diagnosis, psychiatric and psychological communities have names for the phenomenon: climate distress, climate grief, climate anxiety, or eco-anxiety. The concept is also gradually making its way into the public consciousness. An April survey by Yale and George Mason Universities found that 62% of Americans were at least somewhat worried about climate change. Of those, 23% were very worried. Alice and Laura started seeing a counselor for anxiety and depression in college. Eventually, she began working in building sustainability, where she helped businesses reduce their energy and water consumption. But a few years ago, she began talking to her therapist about the contradictions in her life. "I saw corporations destroying the environment, but I was working for them, and I knew what they were doing was wrong," said Laura, 36, who lives in Atlanta. "It was causing me mental anguish. My therapist advised me to take action on what I could control and try to find another area of work. I just couldn't work in an industry that was harming the earth." So how do people alleviate feelings of stress, anxiety, or depression surrounding the planet's fate? Good question. Bryant, the Seattle therapist, said the number one action he recommends is sharing these concerns with others, whether a counselor, psychiatrist, family, friends, or an activist group. There is a lot of underlying worry, but not a lot of dialogue or discussion. And so people feel isolated, Bryant said. Talking about it makes you feel less isolated. And it's also a way to relieve the tension, find a pathway forward, and find a purpose. In that vein, Dr. Janet Lewis, a psychiatry professor at the University of Rochester in New York, recommends building relationships within a like-minded group. That could involve group therapy, environmental activist groups, or online communities. For Laura, becoming involved with the international activist group Extinction Rebellion has helped her build a network of people who share her values and made her feel as if she's making a positive contribution to society. With the group, she has participated in nonviolent protests and is organizing the Atlanta chapter's first grief circle, where people can share their anxiety and grief about the destruction of the earth. "Activism is also therapy for me," said Laura. "Personal action is a way to take control of a situation in which you feel powerless," said Dr. Elizabeth Haas, a psychiatrist at Carson Tahoe Health in Carson City, Nevada. "Small gestures such as taking fewer airline rides or buying local produce can actually make a difference." Susan Clayton, a psychology professor at the College of Worcester in Ohio, said one way to tackle the uncertainty of environmental change is learning how it might specifically affect your community by viewing climate model predictions. If you know what you're going to face, it's not quite as scary, said Clayton, who also co-authored the American Psychological Association's 2017 report on how climate change can affect mental health. Lewis said it's also crucial for people to remember that their mental health response to climate change is often valid. Most of the kinds of pathologies that we're accustomed to treating in psychiatry, they tend to be out of proportion to whatever is going on. But with climate change, this is not inappropriate, she explained. The goal is not to get rid of the anxiety. The goal is to transform it into what is bearable and useful and motivating. Amen to that.
Okay, well, if anxiety about climate change makes you want to eat, this story may be for you.
This from Science Daily. Seeing greenery linked to less intense and frequent unhealthy cravings. Being able to see green spaces from your home is associated with reduced cravings for alcohol, cigarettes, and harmful foods, new research has shown. The study, led by the University of Plymouth, is the first to demonstrate that passive exposure to nearby green space is linked to both lower frequencies and strengths of craving. It builds on previous research suggesting exercise in nature can reduce cravings by demonstrating the same may be true irrespective of physical activity. Researchers say the findings add to evidence that points to the need to protect and invest in green spaces within towns and cities in order to maximize the public health benefits they may afford. They also suggest the causality of this link needs to be investigated further. The study, published in the journal Health and Place, is the first to investigate the relationship between exposure to natural environments, craving for a range of appetitive substances, and the experience of negative emotions or feelings. It involved academics from the University School of Psychology with support from the European Center for Environment and Health at the University of Exeter. Leanne Martin, who led the research as part of her master's degree in Plymouth, said, "It has been known for some time that being outdoors is linked to a person's well-being, but for there to be similar association with cravings from simply being able to see green spaces adds a new dimension to previous research. This is the first study to explore this idea, and it could have a range of implications for both public health and environmental protection programs in the future." For the research, participants completed an online survey that explored the relationships between various aspects of nature, exposure, craving, and negative affect. Among other things, it measured the proportion of green space in an individual's residential neighborhood, the presence of green views from their home, their access to a garden or allotment, and their frequency of use of public green spaces. The results showed that having access to a garden or allotment was associated with both lower craving strength and frequency, while residential views incorporating more than 25% green space evoked similar responses. The study also measured physical activity undertaken within the same time frame that cravings were assessed, showing the reduced craving occurred irrespective of physical activity level. Dr. Sabine Paul, associate professor of psychology, added, "Craving contributes to a variety of health-damaging behaviors such as smoking, excessive drinking, and unhealthy eating. In turn, these can contribute to some of the greatest global health challenges of our time, including cancer, obesity, and diabetes. Showing that lower craving is linked to more exposure to green spaces is a promising first step. Future research should investigate if and how green spaces can be used to help people withstand problematic cravings, enabling them to better manage cessation attempts in the future."
Okay, well, let's end the show with a tip of the hat to women's rights. And folks, let's make it way more than a tip of the hat.
Okay, next up from Science Daily. Nations with strong women's rights likely to have better population health and faster growth. Nations with strong women's rights are more likely to have better health and faster growth than those who don't promote and protect these values. This trend is evident in resource-poor countries, says the researchers. While many parts of the world have made good economic progress, women's rights have often been overlooked. This is despite many countries having signed the International Bill of Rights for Women, formerly known as the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. The researchers wanted to find out if there might be a link between protection of women's rights and health improvement and sustainable development, and if ultimately women's rights might have more of an impact than economic and social or civil and political rights alone. They analyzed databases which held information on health, human rights, and economic and social rights
for 162 countries for the period 2004 to 2010. Countries were grouped according to the respect they afforded to women's economic and social rights. 44 countries were in the high category, 51 in the moderate, and 63 in the poor category. Poor rights. Analysis of the data showed that strong economic and social rights were associated with better or improving health outcomes, possibly because of the spending on health per head of the population. But this wasn't the case when looking at countries based on women's economic and social rights. Overall, countries with strong women's rights had better or improving health than those where women's rights were only moderately or poorly respected. These health indicators include disease prevention, such as vaccination, reproductive health, death rates, and life expectancy. In countries where human rights, to include women's rights, were highly respected, but where access to hospital beds and doctors were nevertheless below average, health outcomes were still consistently better than average. The results confirm that even with a lack of resources, if a country has a strong human rights structure, the health outcomes are better. But countries where civil and political rights alone were highly valued had varying levels of health. And despite some countries respecting economic, social, and cultural rights, they still didn't protect women's economic and social rights. But gender equality is not just a women's issue, but a development issue, they suggest. Today, the value of human rights has often been questioned from an economic standpoint. However, our data find that rather than limit progress, human rights, and women's economic and social rights in particular, can only benefit from them, they conclude. This actually isn't anything new. I remember in graduate school way back in the day in the 80s in an international health course talking about the single most important factor for predicting development of a country. That was the status of women. This remains true. Honor your women, people, and we all do better. And one last message for those of you who'd understand that every health show has to include at least one false conspiracy spot. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real, and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Well, you can listen to this episode again, or any previous episode, or queue up future episodes by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-